Okay, we're just coming on to 7:30, so I think we'll go ahead and get started. So welcome all. If we have any guests with us tonight, by all means, we welcome guests at any time. If you want to join the group, I did paste into the chat where you can go on our website to join the group. If you join before the end of this month, you'll get 2 years for the price of one. So for the low, low price of $20, you'll get a 2 year membership in the Ottawa PC user group. I will mute all now. Find the right button. There we go. And as usual, you will have the ability to unmute yourself. Please feel free to do so. Please remute yourself after you comment or question, so we keep background noise to a minimum. And later on this evening, as usual, the contents of the chat, the audio track, and the deck in PDF format will be going up on our website. So with that, I will turn it over to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck. Alan, take it away.
Thank you, Chris. So first up, we have a couple of follow-up items from last week. And you may remember that I was looking at problems with Windows Update. And Jeff suggested that there's another way to possibly deal with this, which a lot of people may not know about, and that's Microsoft Support. They actually have an 800 number, which is there on the screen. And he says you can explain what you did, try to fix it, grant them remote access, and they will fix it for you. He's used it a couple of times, and both times they've fixed it. So if you ever have any problems with Windows or Microsoft products that you can't resolve, then certainly the support line is an option. And it's not an easy number to find on the web. They really want you to contact them by email or online chats or forms or that kind of stuff. But that is the correct number. Okay, second thing we were talking about, or Bob Harris was talking about checking RAM in PCs for different kind of browsers. And again, Jeff has a suggestion for that. He says one of the best ways to check RAM is to use an online scanning tool from Crucial, who make memory and SSDs and those kind of products. And the tool will basically analyze your system, tell you what kind of RAM you have, what kind of sticks are in use, which slots they're in, and how many slots you have. What you can put in the machine. I'm sure they suggest buying their RAM, and what type of RAM that you need for your particular motherboard. So again, if you have any interest in looking at the RAM ramifications of your system, you need more memory, then crucial.com, and then look for the analytical tool to check out your system. Okay, well, a while ago we were talking about frauds, and one of the things that was mentioned, I think Chris mentioned, using online notifications for things like bank accounts and various kinds of cards, debit cards, credit cards, that kind of thing. And this is just a few slides which give you kind of an overview of what's out there. I think you'll find that lots of different financial institutions have different ways of doing things. So you really have to check your own bank, credit card company or whatever to see what's available to you. But essentially, most of the companies will give you the opportunity to either get default alerts or sign up for various kind of alerts, and that will include account balances and also notice of individual transactions in some cases. And the notifications get sent to you either by SMS text message, email, or the push system. And when one of the alert notification systems actually changes. And I wasn't familiar with push, but push is a a notification system, which if you're using a banking app on some kind of a device, then they can push messages to that app. So you can do things like receive reminders for payments that are due, so you can avoid late payments, or not sufficient funds if you're issuing checks and there's not enough balance to cover it. Some organizations will let you deny any international payments, which essentially stops the Chinese scammers from taking money from you, or at least unless they're using a US bank account. And the bank itself may issue real-time fraud alerts. That's fairly typical. If they detect unusual activity in one of your accounts, typical credit card transactions, for example, then they will generally have some kind of alerting system to tell you that they think there's a problem. So in terms of account balances, typically what you do is you set a low balance threshold. And sometimes that's the default amount. And sometimes you can override that with whatever limit you want. Seems to me that a lot of the default limits are $100. But they also note that the threshold limit may depend on if you have overdraft protection, or if you've received money but the funds that you've received are on hold, then that may change how they view your account threshold. But basically it should let you monitor balances on things like bank accounts, credit cards, and lines of credit if you have such things. For credit and debit cards, some of those companies will let you have real-time alerts for all transactions on your card, and that will include any unauthorized transactions. Many companies will allow you to lock your card, either using an app on your phone or online if you're logging into the system. So if you think there's some kind of issue, especially unauthorized transactions going on, you can actually lock your card temporarily and stop any further action on your card until you can sort it out. However, it turns out that, again, because of the ways different people do things, you may not be able to customize alerts by the transaction type. Sometimes they'll tell you that there's been a transaction and it's for so much money, but they won't tell you whether it's a purchase, a refund, or a cash advance, which means really if you get an alert, you have to go and see on the website or on your app what the actual situation is. And the second thing is, if you have a secondary cardholder, spouse, for example, and they have a different card number, and typically they may have to sign in for their own notification alerts on their own card. So again, that's something to check out. In terms of real-time fraud alerts, I think we're all aware that credit card companies and debit card companies, they monitor the transactions and they try to look for potential fraud. So I'm sure most people have had some kind of query on a transaction that they've tried to make, and you have to explain why that is or whatever. And they say that they use various factors. They don't tell you what they use to do that, but I mean, clearly, if you buy gas at Costco in Ottawa, right now, and 5 minutes later, you're buying a television in Florida, that's a big red flag. So they're going to stop anything that happens like that. Again, they'll contact you by text, email, or even phone to authenticate that the transaction was in fact you and was desired. And transactions can be declined and cards may be locked. So you have to contact your financial institution to sort things out. And because they're sending you stuff, I think it's a good idea to check ahead of time how your particular bank or credit card company may contact you if you get one of these alerts, because clearly the scammers also send alerts and try to con you into giving them banking credentials so they can hack your account, essentially. So a couple of examples of things that you can do. Here's a bank where you can set low balance thresholds. And this individual has two different accounts. And on one account, the threshold is set to $1,000. So they'll only be notified if their balance on that account falls below $1,000. Whereas on the second account, the notification happens when the balance falls below $100. And you note that you can decide whether you want a text message or an email or both or neither, I guess. And then the similar kind of thing for credit cards. In this particular institution, they have fraud protection notifications. So, for example, any kind of unusual activity, this is kind of a default type alert. And again, you can decide, you'll get it in My Messages, which is you generally have to log on or use the banking app to see that. But you can also opt to have email or text messages or push notifications. But then you've got a whole raft of other alternatives, and this is just a few of the ones that are available on this particular institution. One was attempting to draw money from an ATM in excess of the daily withdrawal limit. Second thing was a similar kind of thing on a point-of-sale terminal. And then the final one is a bank machine withdrawal where the amount set was $50. So you could set that for any amount you want. Looks like the withdrawal daily limit. So you can only take out $500 anyway. But you can set this. This is a custom field. You can set whatever number you want right there. And then if you move across to the transactions tab, you get similar kind of systems. And here, a scheduled bill payment failed. So if you have, you pay various companies monthly charges automatically, this says that one failed. So that could happen, for example, if your card was out of date and expired. And here's a neat one, the bottom one. You have a new transaction on your credit card over the set amount, and the set amount is $1. So that basically any transaction would trigger that email email and text message alert in this particular case. So so there you go. There's a whole raft of things that you can do with bank accounts, credit cards, debit cards, and that kind of thing. So anything in the comment section on that, Chris?
No, I do have a comment, though, on that last part of transactions and having it over $1. I'm thinking of changing that to over $2 because a lot of the online payment systems that you go when you're trying to buy something, they do something through Google Services to just validate whether the credit card can be charged. And so they'll put through a $2 charge, and then a couple of minutes later, it'll come up with a $2 refund. And if you have it set to $1, which I currently do have it, you'll have these two messages come through saying that, there was this debit and then a credit on it. And so I'm thinking of changing that to over $2 so that I just never see those. So just a thought, if anybody is setting that up and you're buying stuff online, might be an idea to set it over $2.
I notice Allison says she has the same kind of system with PC MasterCard. It's good, but she doesn't get an alert for every transaction. It seems to miss some online purchases and one automatic charge. Interesting.
Yeah, I think on occasion I have not seen something go through either, and I'm not overly concerned about it because I'm really looking for it as a fraud prevention, and so or fraud detection. I mean, if it goes through, it happens, and I'm just hoping that any of the fraudulent ones do come through. If the occasional one is missed, I'm not too worried about it, but interesting that other people are seeing it as well.
Well, there's a computer system, you can't expect it to work 100% of the
Yeah, and you can't ask them to reboot.
time. Okay, next up, Chris has got a share on disk partitioning.
Yeah, so Alan had a three-part series on partitions at recent Q&As, and it was really great. It talked about why you would want to partition and how to go about doing it and things like that. So the URLs are there, and I pasted them into the chat as well, so you can pick up those particular sessions from our Q&As if you're interested in going back over them. Next. So I have one problem with partitioning, and it comes down to when you reuse old disks. So let's say that you're disposing of an old computer, and next, and you want to reuse the hard drive. So why not? I mean, generally speaking, the hard drives are still good. You could either put them internally into a new computer, or you could put them into an enclosure and then plug it into a USB port or however you want to use that that disk on a new computer. Next. And you go to delete all the partitions on the drive because you want to set it up, say, as one single large partition. And you can't delete some partitions. So this is particularly a problem on operating system disks that were used for an operating system. Next. So yeah, you've likely run into a problem on recovery partitions, and Alan did talk about recovery partitions and the fact that they exist. And generally speaking, you just want to leave them there. There have been some issues recently with recovery partitions that weren't big enough, and Microsoft was trying to push down an update that didn't happen properly on some computers because the recovery partition wasn't big enough and things like that. But generally speaking, you just let them be. They're not overly huge. But in this case, you might run into an issue where you want to reuse that space and it's not going to let you do it. Next. So the fly in the ointment is that Windows won't let you delete protected partitions. And there are typically two types of protected partitions. There's recovery partitions and there's EFI system partitions. And I'm not going to get into what these really are all about and why they're there and things like that. But the fact is that on an operating system drive, you're likely to see at least a recovery partition and possibly as well an EFI system partition. Next. So there's two ways that you can delete any partition, including these protected partitions. There's the hard way, which doesn't require any extra tools, but it requires some manual typing in of commands. Or there's the easy way, where you have to download a free program that will allow you to do it in a graphical user interface. Next. So as you see the screenshots that are going to be coming up, note that I have a recovery partition. It is on my main disk drive, my main system disk, and I do not want to delete that partition, so I'm just going to pretend that I want to delete this partition. I did have before an external hard drive that actually did have one of these that I was going to use for that, and I can't find that external hard drive, so I can't do a real live demo here of actually deleting it. So just pretend that I actually want to delete the partition as we pointed out. Next. So be really, really careful, especially if you're using the hard way and it requires typing in commands and things like that. You want to make sure that you delete the right partition because the guardrails are sort of off now, and if you go through this, you can delete stuff that you really decided you, oh, I didn't want to delete that one. I wanted to delete this other one. So make sure that you don't delete the partition that is containing your operating system or any other data that you want to keep because it'll be gone. There are recovery utilities that you can go through to recover a deleted partition, but I wouldn't count on it, and they're also not for the faint of heart. Next. So one thing you might want to do is if you have other removable disks on your computer, eject them so that you don't accidentally pick one of them. And then spend a little bit of time with the disk management utility to identify all your drives and partitions to make sure that you're selecting the right one. Next. Okay, so here's how you go about doing it. And this is, again, it's the hard way, but it requires no additional software to be installed on your computer. So you right-click on the Start button, next, and then you choose Disk Management, next. And then the Disk Management utility opens up, and it identifies all of your storage devices that are currently attached to your system. So here I'm pointing to a 2 terabyte internal hard drive, next. I also have a 1 terabyte internal SSD, and that is my main Windows partition. And you can actually see it over on the right-hand side or in the center section. You know, it actually identifies it as Windows, C colon, so forth. So we can see that that's where the operating system actually is. Next. I also have a 2 gigabyte recovery partition. And this is the sort of thing that you will typically see on a drive that has been used for the operating system, is you'll see this partition that is identified as being a recovery partition. Next. And then I also have 2 external hard drives. Now, if I followed my advice, I would have ejected those drives so that I didn't accidentally select one of them and delete a partition that actually contained data that I actually want to have. And Norm, I'm going to mute you. Okay, so if you right-click a normal partition, you'll get a pop-up menu, and one of the options is delete volume. Okay, so that's how you can actually delete a partition under normal circumstances. Next. But if you right-click on the recovery partition, you'll notice that the pop-up menu doesn't have any option to delete volume. It's a protected partition. So within disk management, I can delete a normal partition, but I can't delete a recovery partition from within disk management. Next. So it's not really hard, but you do have to type in a bunch of commands, and you have to be careful. There's no undo. The guardrails are off. Next. So what you want to do is run a command prompt as administrator. So if you click on the Start button and just type in CMD, next, you'll get in the results search or the best match, you'll see that you have a command prompt, and you right-click on that, and then you can choose next, run as administrator. Now, in Windows 11, once you click on or once you get the results up, the best match, you'll also have a pane over on the right-hand side which has run as administrator, so you don't have to right-click on it and choose run as administrator. But under Windows 10, I believe you still have to do it this way. And this will work in Windows 10 or Windows 11, where you right-click on where it says command prompt and choose run administrator. Next. So then it'll open up the command prompt, and this is where you have to start typing things in. So you type in disk part, all one word. Next. And it'll come up with some information, or it comes up with its banner stuff at the top. And the disk part is the prompt that you're at. And you type in list space disk. Next. And it'll come up with all of the physical disk drives that are in your system at this point in time. So you can see I have disk 0 through disk 4. And disk 4 is actually showing as no media, and that's because disk 4 is actually a an SD card reader. So, and at this point in time, there's nothing in the card reader. So if I look at disk management, I can see they are identified the same way. Disk 1 through, in this case, disk 4. And next. Then you type in select disk 1 because I want to delete that recovery partition that is over on the right-hand side, and that is on disk 1. So I say select disk 1, next, and then you type in list partition, next, and it'll list out the partitions that are on that particular device And the one that I want to deal with is partition 4 recovery. Next. So then you select partition 4, so that's the active partition within disk part. Next. Okay, so you've selected the right disk, you've selected the right partition, and then if you type in delete partition, the partition will be deleted, but only if it's a normal partition. So it won't work if it is a protected partition. Because this is a protected partition, it's a recovery partition, I have to type in delete partition override. So the override is the thing that tells disk part to actually delete a protected partition. Do that, and then that partition will be deleted. Next. So that's how to do it the hard way, and it's not really all that hard, but you have to be careful to make sure you select the right disk, select the right partition, and give the right commands within the disk part utility. So there is a little bit of an easier way where you just do it through a graphical user interface. And so it's a little bit easier. You don't have to type in any commands at all. You just point and click on things. You still have to be careful. You want to make sure that you're deleting the right partition. Next. So there are a couple of options on that. AOMIA, I think it is, Partition Assistant. It has a similar layout to Windows Disk Management, but it allows you to delete any partition, including protected partitions such as the recovery partition and the EFI system part. Next. So there is AOMI Partition Assistant Standard, which you can download for free. And the URL is there, and the URL has been pasted into the chat as well. Next. Another option is EaseUS Partition Master Free. And so that is available from the EaseUS company. Very similar in its layout and how it actually works, and similarly free. Next. So I'm going to show in the AOMI Partition Manager. And so when it comes up, you can see it looks similar to the layout of disk management utility that comes with Windows. And in this case here, I've identified on disk 1, partition 4, and I can see that it's the recovery partition. So that's the one that I want to delete. And so I select the partition from either of the two windows. I can either do it from the partition list at the top, or I can do it from the layout menu at the bottom, which shows the same information just in a different layout. Next. And then you click on delete partition. And whether it's a protected partition or a normal partition, it'll happily go ahead and delete that for you. Next. You have to click apply. So it gives you that one extra step to go that you say, okay, double check that you really got the right disk, the right partition, and then you've selected the delete partition, click on the apply, and it'll go ahead and happen. Next. So at that point, you can use all the disk space on there, so you can create a new partition, format it, and Alan's instructions, again, are in one of the decks there for creating new partitions. You can also use AOMI Partition Assistant Standard or EaseUS Partition Master Free to deal with partitions, including creating and formatting partitions as well. Mm-hmm. Or you can switch back to the Windows utility to actually do that. And that's it.
So, okay, thanks, Chris. Yeah. So Tom mentioned that if you want to get rid of the contents of the entire disk, then you can use the DBAN program, bootable disk, and that will get rid of everything. And if you want to reuse a hard drive from a desktop PC, for example, you can buy an external USB case, which has usually a SATA connection or USB connection, and it's just he says $5 to $20. And then you basically just drop the hard drive into the case, and you have an external USB drive.
Yeah. The DBAN will definitely work. And there's a number of other utilities that are also used for wiping disks. The one comment I would have on that is I think the fastest you could run DBAN on any sort of size disk, I don't believe it allows you to just delete partitions. It's designed to actually overwrite all your data. And that's going to take could be hours for it to actually run on your particular computer. So it'll work, but it's probably going to be a rather slow process.
Especially if you turn on one of the wiping utilities that does multiple passes.
Yeah. If you're doing it for this purpose, I would definitely do it as a single pass. Even that is going to take long enough to do it. But definitely would do it. And you would end up with a bare disk, put it into the computer. It'll come up as a raw disk, which you can then add partitions to and format them.
And Tristan notes that just be aware that DBAN is only good for spinning hard drives, like regular hard drives, not solid state drives.
Oh, I wasn't aware of that. That's interesting. No.
Okay, thanks very much, Chris. So next up, we have an item on Facebook from Elizabeth. Elizabeth's going to share her screen, unmute her microphone,
okay,
and tell us all about her first impressions on Facebook.
Hopefully.
Yep, we got
it. That works.
Okay. Well, thank you. Yeah, I signed up for Facebook last December, and I'm clearly late to the Facebook party. I guess Facebook started in 2004. But I'm concerned about my privacy, and when I was working, I didn't think I had time to get my brain around Facebook. So anyway, I did sign up. I put the minimum information into the profile page that they require, and I've been a lurker, essentially. I only have two friends. I don't post. I just sort of I use the marketplace, and that's about it. I did notice that Facebook has an awful lot of settings that you really need to check out. I think I've only seen the tip of the Facebook iceberg, I guess. But tonight, I think I'll just show you some of the ad-related privacy settings that I've come across. Okay, so most people know that if you sign up for Facebook, you can't stop them from collecting information on you. That's what they want to do. Just by virtue of signing up, before you start doing anything on Facebook, they identify your device. They know the operating system. If you don't put anything in your location information in your profile, they'll snip it off the IP address. And I guess if you go on to post photographs, if you don't take the location identifier off the photographs first, they probably can see that. So they want anything and all they can get on you. Now, you can't opt out of seeing ads, but you can influence the type of ads you see. And you can control to a certain extent who has access to your profile and activity information. Now, Facebook, to their credit, and perhaps it's a legal requirement, but they do provide users with a lot of information on the data collection and use. For me personally, it's like drinking out of a fire hose. And it never pays to be complacent on Facebook. I think you have to read carefully, before you jump in. Most of the information I got on the slides came from Wired.com, and there's the breadcrumbs on the bottom there. So, this is my homepage for Facebook. It's probably a bit fuzzy for you guys, but I mean, there's the profile picture at the top right, and you click on that, and it opens up, it opens up a number of things. I'm going to focus on three pages on Facebook: the privacy checkup, the privacy center, and the activity log. Okay, privacy checkup. The page looks like this. It opens up and there's five tiles. I don't know what these things are called. I just call them tiles anyway. But there's four tiles where it's pretty straightforward. What you get is what you see. You're best advised to get in there and see what the settings are behind there and understand them. Can't get into that tonight. There isn't time. I'm going to focus on the ad preferences tile, the pink one at the bottom. This tile gives you a cursory view of Facebook's use of ads, and then they ask you to check a couple of options. One of the options that confused me when I first read it was, who can see your social interactions alongside ads? I didn't really understand what that was, but you do understand after you get into it a bit. But the bottom line is that this pink tile with ad preferences on Facebook is not the whole picture. You have to get into the privacy center and dig around a bit to get a little bit more ad control. So I'll try to show you the privacy checkup page on my account, if I can. Okay, so can you see this?
Yep.
Okay, so here's the privacy checkup. There's the four tiles I was talking about you should check out. Ad preferences. First of all, behind this pink tab is, pink tile is a little blurb on ads and how Facebook uses ads. And then they ask you to check out a few fields in your profile. And then they get into social interactions. So here's the blurb on ads on Facebook. I noticed with Facebook, they couch the language as if they're doing you a favor. Like they say, the ads you see on Facebook are personalized based on what we think you're interested in and so on. We want to show you the ads that are relevant and useful to you. Thanks, Facebook. But to be fair, they do, in this blurb, they do mention essentially what they're doing. They say, we use information such as what you do on Facebook and other meta products. And they also mention that they consider what you do off of Facebook, such as non-Facebook websites and apps. Now, I notice the blurb has a tip at the bottom. And with Facebook, I found that if they give you a tip, you better read it. This tip says, to decide whether we can use information about what you do off of Facebook to show you ads, you can visit ad preferences, which is fine. Too bad they don't give you a link to ad preferences. That would be useful, but they don't. Okay, so here's the profile information. These relationship, employer, job title, and education are four fields on the profile information that you fill out when you sign up. I don't recall if these settings were defaulted to on when I first looked at this, but nevertheless, I didn't put anything in for employer or education or anything like that. It's just an on-off toggle here. And again, you have a tip at the bottom here. These settings only affect how your profile information influences the ads. They don't change the information on your profile or who can see the information on your profile. So that's good to understand. Here's social interactions that drew me a curve. Social interactions are defined here pretty well. Likes, follows, comments, shares, app usage, check-ins, and so on. And they give an example of how they use it. So if I received an ad for Jasper's Market and I decided that I liked it and I liked the page, then all my friends would be notified that I liked the page if I allow this setting. So at the bottom is the setting that confused me here. Who can see your social interactions alongside ads? Well, this is what it means. And I have it set to only me because I want to close down Facebook as much as possible. I want to just take advantage of who's on Facebook and what I can learn from Facebook without showing too much of myself. I'm a lurker, in other words. So there's only two selections here. It's only me or my friends. So I thought I was pretty good at this point. It says I'm all set. So I thought, good, no problem. Yeah, we are not completely all set in this case. Okay, so yeah, we've got to go to the Privacy Center and see a few more settings. Privacy Center, okay. This page opens up 11 tiles addressing a number of issues and data collection and so on. I'm going to focus on the ads tile where they ask you to manage the ads you see on Facebook. You open the ads tile, you click on review ad preferences, and then there's four settings of interest. There's a bit of an overlap here with the privacy checkup in that the profile information and the social interaction settings are just the same, so we won't look at that. But the two other settings that I'll show you is the information Facebook ad partners share about you and where Facebook ads appear when you use other apps. So I'll try to bring up the Privacy Center. Okay, so like I said, there's 11 tiles. I'll just show you slowly all the tiles that are on here, different topics. Now, this last tile at the bottom, we'll talk about later, but it's important because you can download all the information Facebook has on you from that last tile. So I'll go back up to the ads tile. This is Privacy Center as opposed to Privacy Checkup, remember? Okay, so here we are, review ad preferences. I have to select Facebook here. Now, it defaults to customize ads, which is all fun and games, but I'm going to go to manage info. And as I said, there's a bit of an overlap here. The information from my profile, we've already looked at. So just focus on information other advertisers share about you. So here's where you choose whether or not they use information from ad partners to show you ads. I mean, Facebook has a deal with other businesses whereby you visit their site, and I guess they send the IP address and God knows what else over to Facebook. I mean, I'm not sure what they send from other websites. It could be your IP address, but it could be the number of times you've been on the website, what you did on the website, and so how long you stayed and so on. I don't know. But anyway, I have it set to not using this information. I'll just skip that for now. And these are the options. It's yes or no. Yes, show me ads that are more relevant by using ad partner information, or no, don't make my ads more relevant. So I have it set to no. And you have to remember that if you set these things to no, it just means that you don't get the ads under those conditions. It doesn't mean you see fewer ads. Okay. So, and again, I noticed the language that Facebook uses. It says, to show you ads that help you discover new things, it helps to know what you already like. So, anyway, that's that. And the other part of this section here is audience-based advertising. Now, this is where Facebook starts talking about their business model, essentially, audience-based advertising. Advertisers go to Facebook. I don't know if this is helpful for you to see where I'm at. Advertisers go to Facebook with a list of criteria they want to target and people for ads. And Facebook combs through all the profiles and the activity and sends you an ad. One thing I did note on this page is that there's a link here, Learn More. And when you see a link for Learn More, it's worthwhile to get behind it because this particular link leads you to some settings that are very important. We won't go in there. It's a lot. It's another rabbit hole. Okay. Okay, so that's audience-based advertising. Then where you see ads shown by Meta. You choose if you get ads shown by Meta in other apps. So again, the way I understand this is that Facebook has a stable of advertisers who wish to advertise on other websites and applications. And so Facebook, Meta, plays the middleman role between the businesses that want to get onto apps and the apps themselves. So these businesses use their ad services. And again, there's a Learn More link here that's worthwhile going into. And you can, again, choose not to get the ads delivered in this way. I have it set to off as well. Okay, so that's, and the other settings of social interactions, we already went through that with the privacy checkup. So good, that's it. So the only other thing I'll say about the ads is that if you're on your homepage and you see an ad that really bugs you, you can dismiss it. It's the usual three dots at the top right corner of the ad itself, and you can dismiss it and not see it again. And the final thing is the activity log. This is where Facebook kind of shows you how they organize all the activity that they track with you. There's a lot of dots they can put together if you get into it. I'll try to find that one too. Activity log. Anyway. So on the right-hand side here, these are the categories of activity that Facebook puts together videos, your search history day by day, search by search, they keep track of it, groups, posts, and so on, where you're logged in. I'll just show that. Here I am. I'm logged in right now. You know, here's my browser, Mozilla, and all the rest of it. I noticed when I was preparing for this that I liked somebody by mistake. This guy here. I liked his video. So anyway, that's okay. I still like him. Okay. Now, that's the right-hand side. The left-hand side is, is it blocked a bit by something? Anyway, okay. So the activity log has more information on the left-hand side here. You can really get into the weeds here on the activity that they're collecting on you. So that's good. So that's the activity log, and yes, here. Now, Facebook tracks your activity, from what I can tell, even when you're not using it. And you might think that we already covered that when, you know, we were talking about the Privacy Center. But just as an example, I could be a Facebook client, and I could belong to a birdwatching organization that maybe doesn't do a lot of advertising. They don't sell binoculars or whatever, but they have a deal with Facebook to share information. So in this way, Facebook may not be using the birdwatching organization to sell ads to, but they're going to accept all the information they can get on me to build the profile. So this is an example of how this might work. In order to stop that, you get into settings and privacy again, and you dive down into manage future activity, and you click on disconnect future activity. Now, what does disconnect mean? Don't ask me. But anyway, it's there, and I said disconnect. For sure, Facebook is not rejecting any information that the organization wants to send if I say disconnect. So they're still going to gather the information. They're going to monetize it somehow. But it's going to be disconnected if that's comforting to you. And so this information and a lot more is available on allaboutcookies.org. And, okay, so here's my last slide. I suggest that you download the information that Facebook has on you. Now, we just saw that in the Privacy Center, the very bottom tile, you can download. I don't know if it's comprehensive. You'd have to have a look. I would suggest also, well, I've read that it's a good idea to not install Facebook on your cell phone unless you want to share your contacts and maybe other stuff such as location. I know that I bought my iPhone a long time ago, like 3 years ago, and I had a Facebook icon on there. I haven't tried to use it, and I won't, but I hope my contacts are not being shared. Using a privacy-first browser is a good idea anyway. And it's been suggested that you use the incognito mode as much as possible. Now, I can see that the advantage of the incognito mode is that whether you're on Facebook or not, you open up a browser, go into incognito mode, visit a website, and they don't pass the IP address over to Facebook. I don't know. But I guess I don't know if there's any more advantage to using incognito mode. I haven't tried to use Facebook in incognito mode, so I might try that someday. But anyway, so that's my presentation.
Thank you, Elizabeth. That was really great. We did have one comment from, I believe it was Jeff, on there's an add-in called Fluffbuster that can help with privacy issues. And then some comments about Firefox and how it definitely can help you on that. And I think that's it. So, yeah, Alan, let's move onward.
Okay, thanks very much, Elizabeth. And I have an item now, basically, which has got solved, and I just want to point out how we did it. I had a friend who was using Access 2013, the Microsoft Database Manager, and needed to update, and she was looking at going to Access 2016. My question was that even possible, since Microsoft's moved forward to Office 2019, Office 2021, and currently Office 365. But my friend isn't a fan of subscription software, so 365 is probably a no-go. So my question, which I posted on the user forum, was, are there any one-time purchase versions of Access available? And if so, where can you buy one? And there's lots of information on the web, but it's very confusing. There's lots of different versions of Office. Very few of them include Access. They're mainly just Word, Excel, and PowerPoint. And Office has got various versions now. Microsoft, if you try and search for Access, you'll get directed to Office 365. And trying to find a one-time purchase of anything certainly isn't easy. I did find a listing on Microsoft Canada for Office Professional 2021, and that includes Access, and they wanted $569 as a one-time purchase. So what do you do? Well, you ask your buddies at OPCUG. And I almost instantly got a reply from Bill Van Dyke, who suggested Shareware on sale. He says they regularly have the Office Suite 2019 on sale, and that includes Access. And sure enough, I went and had a look, and it's the Professional Edition, Professional Plus 2019, and it was on sale for $40, that's US dollars, from this website. Now, I'm always dubious about buying stuff for cheap on websites, because you never know whether it's valid or not. But I seem to remember that we talked about Shareware on sale on the meeting somewhere. I couldn't remember whether it was a Q&A session or whatever. But I went into the email system, Google Groups, for the members forum, and basically did a search using this icon here for Shareware on sale, and it got me all kinds of stuff, including the one I just posted that day. But this one right here, if you look at that one, it's a link from a message from Chris, actually to Elizabeth, saying that he thinks Shareware on sale has been used by other people in the group, and as far as I know, it's legitimate, even though he's only used it for freeware. And if you look further down, you'll find a link here from June, I think, or maybe March of 2022. Oops, sorry. Come back to me. and this was, again, a question about Office Professional Plus 2021. And Bob Gowan had suggested Shareware on sale. And Bill had asked at that time, this is March, you know, is it legitimate? And Bob Walker came in and said, well, for that particular deal, you have to authorize the license through the Microsoft Store. So he reckoned it must be okay. So I passed all that information on to my friend, and she actually bought the package and tells me for $45 Canadian, she now has Office 2019 installed, which includes Microsoft Access. Okay, finally we have Chris with a question.
Just before we move on with that, just there are some comments in the chat on a couple of other places. You can also buy it, TechSpot, as well as there is another place, softwarekeep.ca, to buy software as well. So if you're interested in this sort of thing, you have at least three options, sounds like. Okay, so this was an email that came in from Glenn to the suggestion box at opcug.ca. So he was saying that he used to do searching for information at Google, and so you'd get lots of results, typically million page hits and things like that. But even on page one or two, you could get a lot of different results, and you could compare the answers. And basically what you could do is you could see What's the answer that tends to appear most frequently is most likely going to be the correct answer? And you could give extra weight to answers that come from, you know, sites that you already know about and you trust. And so you could give a little bit more weight to the answers that come from them. Next. So now, you know, we're starting to look into using AI chatbots. In particular, he was using Microsoft Copilot, which uses ChatGPT. Microsoft will argue that it's not pure ChatGPT, but it's based on that. And so he uses that to get answers to questions. The problem was that it is important to follow up, and I have a slide later on talking about more detail why that's the case, but it's important to follow up with the reference links that they give to see how they arrived at their conclusions and the answers they're giving you. The problem is that Copilot sometimes only gives one or two links in support of what it's telling you. And so it sort of hobbles your ability to be able to assess whether the answers are reasonable or not. And so frequently he says he wasn't familiar with those websites, so they weren't trusted websites that he had visited before and could count on the information. And there were not enough references to be able to sort of average things out and see what the you know, the collective wisdom is in the answers. Next. So looking at a website that could rate the accuracy, so he is looking for a website that could rate the accuracy or the biases of, you know, this limited set of websites that are referenced in an AI answer so that he could, you know, get a better sense of whether the information is accurate or not. Next. So why is it important? Well, we've probably all heard about this, but AI hallucinations. So just a couple of examples of the outrageously crazy answers that were given. A New York attorney actually used ChatGPT to craft a motion, and it turned out it was full of totally made-up information. That attorney got sanctioned and fined for just, you know, parroting what ChatGPT came out with, which was just flat-out wrong information. Next. When Microsoft was asked on one chatbot what was Microsoft's 2021 annual revenues, it came back with an answer of $10 billion. Well, the correct answer was actually $168.1 billion. When you're out over a magnitude, that's a bit of a problem. Next. Here's a quote of an answer that was given to by a chatbot. You know, the world record for crossing the English Channel entirely on foot is held by this guy from Germany who completed the crossing in 14 hours, 51 minutes in 2020. You know, it all sounds very authoritative until you actually say, what? Next. And then how about this one? The Golden Gate Bridge was transported for the second time across Egypt in October of 2016. I mean, you know, obviously foolish information, but if you're getting stuff that is maybe not so easily identifiable as being, you know, just completely outrageous information, you might just accept it as being, oh, okay, the chatbot, it did its research and whatever it had to, and it came up with the final answer, and I'll trust it. Well, maybe we shouldn't be so trustworthy of AI chatbots. Next. So I went down the rabbit hole a little bit on that, and it looks like there are some potential solutions coming out. So NVIDIA actually has an open source project called NeMo Guardrails. And I've included the URL for that, and I'm pasting it into the chat window now. And so it claims to be able to identify hallucinations by cross-checking with more than one large language model or more than one chatbot against another to see whether the information is actually accurate or not. Next. And there's another place called Got It AI Truth Checker, which basically does the same sort of idea, uses AI, ironically, to detect hallucinations in any content that is generated by ChatGPT in particular, and I think this was with ChatGPT 3.5 or above. And it claims to detect up to 95% hallucinations automatically. Now, anytime somebody says up to, well, 1% is up to 95%. So it may be that it's not as impressive as who knows if it ever hits 95%. But it's interesting that there are companies that are actually looking at this as a problem and trying to come up with a solution. Next. Now, unfortunately, currently, those two solutions are not consumer-level tools. The NVIDIA in particular seems to be an open-source project that is designed for companies that are doing large language models, and they can build these guardrails into the tools that they are actually building and so forth. Got it. AI's truth checker. They have a button there saying that, you know, a sandbox app is coming soon, where I presume at some point consumer level people will be able to somehow be able to take advantage of this up to 95% hallucination checking automatically. But right now, it doesn't seem to be anything that's there. Next. For consumers, I think really it's going to come down to you're going to have to manually check the results using a search engine. So basically you could go and take that and then go back to a regular search engine and see if there is concurrence across a wider spectrum than the one or two results that the chatbot actually came up with for it to come up with its conclusions. And I'd like to know if anybody else actually has come across any other solutions, or, you know, what are other companies doing to try to combat these hallucinations that the AI chatbots put out. So if anybody has any information, if you could share it, that'd be great. We're right at the end of tonight's hour-long session. So if somebody has something, maybe you could fire it into suggestion box at opcug.ca email address, and we could include it in a future Q&A.
Well, just take it to the court and see what the judge says.
Yeah. Well, the lawyer got sanctioned for using just out flat wrong information. Yeah, he took it to the judge.
So just a note that there's a language model that you can run on your own computer if you have a powerful video card, llama.com. So I guess that means you could generate your own hallucinations. Or perhaps you could check other people's hallucinations. Yeah.
I think it's really fascinating how these large language models sometimes just come out with stuff that is outrageously wrong. And I don't think you could find anywhere on the internet that would actually say that, you know, somebody walked across the English Channel in 2020 and set a new record. So I don't know how they come up with some of these hallucinations. It's sort of a fascinating idea that they could come out with something so wrong. Very interesting.
Except now we're all going to have to Google that, Chris, to see.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Okay, we're over time, so no last 10 minutes here. I asked if anybody had any questions, and nobody said anything. So just a couple of quick things to finish off. We are in March, and our 2-for-1 offer, which Chris mentioned at the front, is only available until the end of the month. So if you know anybody who wants to join the club, now is the time to do it. Buy a membership for $20, and you'll end up getting 2 years of membership for the price of one. And just again, a note, if you are a current member of the club, do not send us any money, because your membership will be renewed for a year automatically. Okay, finally, next week is our regular meeting night, and this guy, German, is going to be talking about building websites and not needing any HTML coding. So we'll see how true to his word he is on that. And because it's a regular meeting night next week, there is no Q&A. So our next Q&A will be March the 20th, which gives you lots of time to get all the answers to Chris's question about large language model hallucinations and checking them into suggestion box. And all your other questions and topics that you'd like to share, like Elizabeth did tonight, and we're always really happy to receive that kind of information. So that's it for me. Hope everybody enjoyed the evening, and we'll see you next week.
Thanks, everybody, for your participation. It was a great session.